NOLA History Guy podcast for Saturday, September 10th, 2016. And welcome to NOLA History Guy podcast. Well, summer is over, not so much from a heat and humidity standpoint, and we're still kind of sweating the hurricane season. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, personally, these days since 2005, when we get past August 29th, I personally breathe easier, but that's still the physics of you know, and the meteorology of everything. We're still in the summer hurricane season, but by every other social standard, we've kind of hit the end of summer, because last weekend was Labor Day, and that's a big thing. And I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the big things of the summer in New Orleans that Labor Day was the closing time for, and that's Pontchartrain Beach. You know, Labor Day is a milestone in many aspects of American life. Labor Day is the end of the quote-unquote official end of summer. You're supposed to stop wearing white shoes. It was the traditional start for presidential and congressional campaigns. You know, there really was a time when it was considered sort of unseemly to campaign during the summer. You know, you might go out and shake some hands, you know, at picnics and that kind of thing, but you didn't really go into full-on attacks on your opponent and that kind of thing. But Labor Day also was a big deal in New Orleans from a sports standpoint, because we've been a big minor league baseball town throughout the history of baseball, basically, with a, you know, with a couple of decades of interruption, if you will, from in, well, really primarily the 60s and part of the 70s. We basically, New Orleans has been a big minor league baseball town, what with the Pelicans going back into the early 1900s, and then the sort of return of the Pelicans, but then now, of course, the New Orleans Zephyrs. And Labor Day is the end, or marks the end of the minor league baseball season, because that's when the AAA players that are, you know, go up and rejoin the major league team, and September becomes the major league, you know, becomes the show. It becomes the race to the playoffs. From a school standpoint, of course, the day after Labor Day was traditionally the start of school. Now, in New Orleans, a lot of schools, in particular Catholic schools, started their academic term in August. Public schools still for a long time, almost right up to Hurricane Katrina, started on the day after Labor Day. As a high school teacher in the 1980s, I can tell you that one of the main reasons for a lot of the Catholic schools starting early was the heat. The theory was that you didn't want to extend the school year into the summer, into June, because it was starting to get really hot and humid. Yeah, the idea was, you know, sure, it's miserable out there right now, and if you were in a non-air-conditioned classroom, it was rough for those beginning weeks in August and early September. But better to be rough on the front end than to have a whole bunch of kids who have been working all year and now are restless and grumpy at the end of the year because of the heat. That, and of course, the other issue naturally was hurricane season, that the longer you didn't want school to go into hurricane season if you could avoid it. So the day after Labor Day kind of creeped up on us, but still, that was the significant day, right? You know, that kind of thing. Labor Day, of course, is one of the big summer weekends. It's the, you know, one of the big reasons for celebration and that kind of thing. And New Orleans was no different in that respect than the rest of the country in terms of those days. Memorial Day, kind of the kickoff of of the summer break, summer vacation for kids, the 4th of July, kind of the mid-season sort of thing. And then, of course, Labor Day. Yeah, it's kind of not really following baseball, because baseball starts in April. But, you know, that idea that, you know, the All-Star break and 4th of July kind of around the same time, and then everything wrapping up and getting back down to it in by Labor Day. And Labor Day in New Orleans, again, pretty much the same kind of thing that you'd see in other parts of the country. Picnics, cookouts, folks going out to Heinemann Park, then Pelican Stadium, now Zephyr Field for those last few ball games. Some people will head out of town to the beach on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, or go even as far as Florida. And then, of course, so many people would take would head out to the lakefront at that point. Now, you know, you had picnics and family get-togethers and cookouts in other parks all over the city, depending on your neighborhood and that kind of thing. And then just a lot of people would just migrate out to the lakefront for that big blowout. And one of the things that has always been a part of that, and just a part of going out and day trips and weekend entertainment in general in New Orleans, has been to go out to the lakefront to the different entertainment venues that are out along the lakeshore. From that goes all the way back to the antebellum times, goes back to the 1850s with entertainment, the hotels and other entertainment attractions at West End and at Spanish Fort, and then later in Gentilly in Milneyburg. The whole idea of going out to the lakefront for entertainment, for more than just the going out for a day trip, bring a picnic basket, that kind of thing, that's always been there. But the big attractions, or going out like for an evening, or going out maybe and checking into one of the hotels and spending the night, really kicked in after the Civil War. So that in the 1880s up until the 1910s, West End and Spanish Fort kind of went back and forth with this, where you had West End would be very popular for 10 or 20 years, and then Spanish Fort would pick up again. But by the 1880s, 1890s, Spanish Fort had kind of taken over in that respect and kind of dominated in terms of entertainment. A lot of jazz musicians would go to the restaurants and the nightclubs out there. A casino had opened up. Spanish Fort was known as the Coney Island of the South and was marketed that way to out-of-town visitors of the city. And we've talked about that in previous podcasts, but want to carry on now from past that time. You know, the Great Hurricane of 1915 really messed up West End, and it took a while to recover. Same with the with Spanish Fort, that it took a little rebuilding time and that kind of thing. And different ventures had started out there, but throughout all of that, or you know, in that time frame, there was basically Spanish Fort was still a very, very viable and interesting area. One of the players in that particular scene, in the venue that was Spanish Fort, was a New Orleans family, the Batts. And the Batts owned an ice manufacturing plant. That was the family business for years. And it serviced a lot of the venues at Spanish Fort. And one of the Batts, Harry J. Batts Sr., worked in the family business, and he followed the ups and downs of the entertainment venues along the lake. You know, he was the ice guy, you know, his family. So Bat had observed the decline of the Spanish Fort amusement area, those restaurants and everything on the west side of Bayou St. John and the lake. He observes this, and in the 1920s, you know, going into the 1920s, he forms a company called Playland Amusements, and the idea was he was going to put together a new amusement park somewhere on the lake. Now, Bat was looking, he was keeping an eye on a lot of what was going on the lakefront. He knew that the city and the levee board had very, very ambitious plans, serious plans to develop the lakefront and reclaim land along the lakefront. You know, we think of the lakefront now with the 30s era seawall as this big, magnificent area. But at the time, a lot of the lakefront was just like fishing camps and marshy, shallow, kind of the water just kind of, turning into land and kind of swampy marsh area. And the city and the levee board, their goal was that, there's acres of land here that all we have to do is drain this and build it up a little bit. And we can turn that into, again, more real estate and more land for the city, reclaim that, looking at some of the models of what the Dutch were doing and that kind of thing. That became a very, very ambitious goal for the city in the 1920s. And Harry Batt was one of the developers who wanted to take advantage of the changes that were coming to the area. Now, there were some hurdles here. You know, there was visions of expanding out and making a grand boulevard, a grand thoroughfare along the lakefront. And then, the idea of a seawall and make a clean lakeshore and that kind of thing. But there were still some issues and problems with that, most notably up in the area of Milneburg. Now, basically you had starting at West End and going through what is now the different Lakeview neighborhoods, East West Lakeshore, East Lakeshore, then going up to Bayou St. John with Lake Vista, and then, of course, by Spanish Fort there, and then the entertainment area, cross Bayou St. John into what is now the levee board neighborhood of Lake Terrace, and then you get into what became the Navy base and is now UNO, and that brings us to Milneburg. And in the early 1920s, I've got a great picture in the jazz book of the little village of fishing camps that was out by the Milneburg Lighthouse in the 1920s. And in the late 1910s and 1920s, you had a lot of jazz musicians that, they were playing dances and gigs in, the various ballrooms and clubs and such in town. But then either they'd come in a day before or they'd come, in the early evening, and then they would head out to Milneburg and go out to those fishing camps in the summer and basically play for tips and just busk in the area, come knock on door and play for somebody in the hopes that they'd get, give them a tip, that sort of thing. So that fishing camp area was kind of an escape for a lot of New Orleanians, come out and, spend the weekend in your little camp and get the cool air and that sort of thing. But a lot of those fishing camps were basically destroyed under some questionable circumstances in a huge fire in 1923. That fishing village out there basically burned down. But then, of course, there are people that will, say, oh, that was convenient, because then, of course, that cleared the way for the extensive development from West End all the way to the Industrial Canal. Now, there were delays. There were still, civil delays and legal delays and that kind of thing with getting this whole thing going and building out and extending the Lake Pontchartrain area so that there was that and then financial setbacks, both with the city and state government. So the overall improvement of the lakefront kind of stalled a little bit, was not as dramatic as developers like the Bats wanted it to be. But Harry went ahead and, that's a lot of that reclamation was taking place and moving forward, so that by 1928, Bat went ahead with plans to open a new amusement park at Spanish Fort, but not on the east side of Bayou St. John, where the original Spanish Fort venues were, but on the other side, on the west side, what's now the Lake Terrace neighborhood, on the other side, the east side of Bayou St. John. And he opens up in 1929 an amusement park that he calls Pontchartrain Beach. And, well, if you're from New Orleans, the name, and that's where it got started. Of course, just as soon, you know, it wasn't the greatest. In a way, it was a blessing and a curse that Bat decided to open his park in 1929. The crash, the stock market crash of 1929, followed by the start of the Great Depression, you know, that complicated development for him in terms of expansion and his original goals. But it, in a way, it actually was, I don't want to say it was a blessing, but the fact that Pontchartrain Beach was there and available and offered very inexpensive entertainment, you know, just, you know, a midway with rides, access to swimming in the lake in a safer environment with a bathhouse where you could plop your stuff and all that kind of thing, was certainly a big deal. Now, the Depression, you would say, you know, geez, yeah, it's like there's always a silver lining to these kind of things. And the big silver lining to the Depression, as far as New Orleans was concerned, was that development around the city and construction around the city and the lakefront in particular got a huge boost with the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1934. By 34, the New Deal programs were immediately starting to kick in. FDR was elected in 32 and then spent 33 kind of pushing the New Deal and fighting for the New Deal in Congress. So that by 34, the programs had been passed, the Works Project Administration and other recovery agencies in the federal government were now taking shape. And that basically, the work that that first year of FDR's administration basically gave fruit to these different construction projects and everything else, starting in 34 and then working throughout the going back then through the 30s to provide jobs and to try to stabilize the American economy. By the WPA, when it got to New Orleans, I mean, it came to New Orleans on a grand scale. There were construction projects all over the city. The lagoon at City Park, Tad Gormley Stadium, other big development projects across the city were implemented and paid for by government, you know, with federal funds. That was a huge thing. This is just an incredibly big deal. The lakefront benefited from a lot of this as well, and development out there was just incredible. The construction projects all over the city were a big deal, but Gentilly and Lakeview, and then along the lake, were some of the biggest. And of that, the most ambitious project for the WPA and on the lakefront was the construction of the seawall to run from the west end, the basically western side of Orleans Parish or the city of New Orleans, back out to the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, the industrial canal in Gentilly. And that was just a huge deal. Now, there were basically of all of those projects, there were two other, in addition to the seawall, I should say, because the seawall is just a big thing. So, two other big WPA projects had a significant impact on Harry Batt and his Playland Amusements Company and his Pontchartrain Beach Amusement Park in the 30s. The first big development, the first big WPA project that was significant to Pontchartrain Beach were the improvements to Elysian Fields Avenue. Now, we know the street now. It's the big four-lane boulevard in Gentilly, wide neutral ground, but it wasn't always that way. I mean, in the 1930s, it wasn't much at all, and that's because Elysian Fields was the route of the Pontchartrain Railroad, the old Smoky Mary train you'll hear people talk about back in the day. Yeah, let's face it, Smoky Mary fizzled out in 1931, so there aren't a lot of people left that rode the Smoky Mary, but people still talk about it as if, you know, fondly, as if they remember that. But basically what you had was a shell road that ran from the back of Faubourg Marigny and then running up and following the train tracks, which is just a linear train line. The Pontchartrain Railroad started down at the, you know, at the river on Elysian Fields, or actually on Charters and on Charter Street and Elysian Fields, and then just went in a straight line all the way up to Port Pontchartrain, to the Mildenburg Lighthouse, and was basically an industrial operation, right? You know, you could, ships would come in and dock at Mildenburg, and then the train would be able to haul goods and people back into the city and vice versa. But the role of the Pontchartrain Railroad changed dramatically by the 1930s, and by 1931, the railroad itself was discontinued, the tracks were ripped up, and all that remained was that shell road. I've got a great photo of that road in the Brothers of the Sacred Heart book, because, you know, of course, with Brother Martin, with my school being right there at Elysian Fields, not far from Gentilly Road, you can see just there's nothing there. You can see Hebrew Rest Cemetery and the Shell Road at Gentilly, and it's really incredible. So developing that area, road construction, paving of, paving roads, improvements like that, that's exactly the kind of stuff that was tailor-made to the Works Project Administration. Put men in the area to work, get them jobs, employed again, and at the same time, improve the infrastructure overall. And the improvements at that point, expanding out Gentilly Road so that it became a main thoroughfare, and then paving and using and turning Elysian Fields from a railroad right of way into a big 4-lane boulevard that would then basically attract people out to the Gentilly neighborhood, and essentially is one of the, I made the argument, I'm not the only one, obviously it made the argument that, you know, Gentilly was in a way the first suburb, really, of the city of New Orleans. If you look at, you know, the sliver on the river kind of thing and the growth up and down the Mississippi River, moving north from there, in a lot of ways, Gentilly is the first true suburb of the city, with respect to post-war development, 1946 to 1950 kind of thing. But that was facilitated way earlier, and that was because of the development, the construction of Elysian Fields Avenue, and that was a big deal. So that new paved road would then, you know, then became the connector. And it meant that Mildenburg was a very, very attractive area at that point. The second big WPA project that was very, very important to Harry Batt. Now, remember, Batt's running Pontchartrain Beach right there by Bayou St. John at this point. But the WPA have other ambitious plans. And one of the projects that was proposed and accepted by the WPA and funded and constructed was to build a big bathhouse and swimming facility along the lakefront. Now remember, they're building that big seawall. So you're building the seawall starting at West End, coming through what is Lakeview, Lake Vista, Lake Terrace. You get up into the area around what is now UNO, and you get to Mildenburg. And Mildenburg had the lighthouse and the big pier and then the train station. So it was developed out a little bit. Yeah, you had all the fire damage from 1923, and the fishing camps weren't what they used to be, but you still had all this area out there. And you'd reclaim some of that land where the fishing camps were. And the proposal at that point was, let's put in a swimming facility there. We've got this new road that's coming in from town. People can easily drive straight up Elysian Fields Avenue and get to the lakefront and can go swimming. So the WPA builds this big bathhouse facility. And then Harry Batt pitches the city, and the city and the state, because this is levee board land, pitches the government to, he says, we'll truck in beach sand from the Gulf Coast and turn a mile of that lakefront area into a real swimming facility. You guys build this bathhouse, we'll set up this big beach area here, and we'll turn this into a real amusement venue. The WPA says, let's do it. Bat says, okay, let me get some sand out here. We expand the whole thing, build it all out. And then he decides, he says, this is perfect. Let's go ahead and relocate the amusement park from Bayou St. John over to Milneyburg, over to the end of Elysian Fields Avenue. That sets the stage for what we, what anybody, I don't want to say anybody still alive, because I'm sure there may be still people out there that remember. Gosh, it's getting, well, you know, just statistically, there aren't going to be many that would remember Pontchartrain Beach by Bayou St. John. But certainly all the fond memories of Pontchartrain Beach out at Elysian Fields begin there in 1939. That bathhouse is constructed. Bat decides to close the amusement park by Bayou St. John and reopen Pontchartrain Beach on Elysian Fields Avenue in Gentilly in Milneyburg. So here we go then. We've got, that's the big thing. We get that what becomes, you know, in everyone's memory is Pontchartrain Beach. So we're going to take a bit of a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about that, talk about where the park went from there as Bat expanded and turned it into the attraction that we all knew and came to love. Okay, and we're back. Let's keep talking. So it's 1939. The Works Project Administration has developed all of this area along the lakefront. They've paved Elysian Fields Avenue. They've tied the city back to the lakefront that way. But you could take, you know, you could drive out to Pontchartrain Beach. You could take a bus, that kind of thing. Well, you could if you were white, is the way to say it. Because while Pontchartrain Beach leveraged federal, state, and local funding, it was still a segregated facility. You know, we're talking Jim Crow era here. So because of that, the law said that if you're using federal funds to build a facility that the owners and, you know, everyone agrees and intends to be a whites-only segregated facility, you had to follow the doctrine of separate but equal, which meant that the city had to construct a quote-unquote separate but equal amusement park and swimming bathing facility for African-American citizens. The decision was there is that to, well, you know, just in typical Jim Crow fashion, it wasn't going to be something as attractive, and certainly there weren't the investors like the Bat family to develop something into a really big deal. But nonetheless, the government had to do something. The something that was done way out in New Orleans East, out toward the end of Hayne Boulevard. Now, Hayne Boulevard was really nothing but fishing camps, again, just, you know, just an extension, just this continuation, I should say, of the lakefront on the eastern side of the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, the Industrial Canal. And then the road that ran along and gave access to those fishing camps was Hayne Boulevard out in New Orleans East. So in 39, the government, the WPA, builds out a beach facility, a swimming entertainment facility, way the heck out past Bullard Road on Hayne Boulevard, and that becomes Lincoln Beach. And that's the separate but equal Jim Crow facility for black folks. And like most Jim Crow era facilities for blacks in the South, it was separate but far from equal. It just wasn't the same. And we'll do a full podcast on Lincoln Beach. But it's easy. I gotta say, this is where, you know, it's kind of This is where the white privilege, if you will, kicks into an extent. With me is I don't have memories of Lincoln Beach for two reasons. One, well, I'm a white guy. Two, the other piece to this is the fact that Lincoln Beach closed in 1964 with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and then court-ordered desegregation. So that becomes a thing in and of itself that, you know, the beach desegregated, and, that's about all there is to that. So I don't have any direct memories of Lincoln Beach. You know, I was 6 years old in 1964, and my family always went out to Pontchartrain Beach. But, you know, I've done a bit of research on this, and we'll continue with that at another point in time. Okay, so back to Elysian Fields and the lakefront and Pontchartrain Beach. So Harry Batt moves his amusement park from Bayou St. John to Milneyburg. This new road is leads right up to his door. He's got this really nice bathhouse facility that's sets up this big sandy beach, and he's just ready for business. And business comes, of course, because it's the Depression, and people are looking for an inexpensive way to blow off some steam or go out and have some fun. And even when the economy was good, day trips to the lakefront were a big deal. But then so Bat was pretty much, he was all set. He was looking pretty good in a lot of ways. And then he gets an additional boost because of World War II. All of a sudden, the city becomes does its part in the war effort. And while there was all, you know, basically so much development in town, there wasn't much you could convert and repurpose inside New Orleans proper, if you will. The lakefront was very, very easy to mobilize for the war effort. The U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army grabbed land. You know, a lot of this is still state-owned at the time. Just grabbed land in Lakeview and in Gentilly out by the lake. All of that levee board land that had been reclaimed was still owned by the levee board by the state at the time. So out in Lakeview, the Army builds a large military hospital there so that what is now basically West Lakeshore, the area between Canal Boulevard and West End Boulevard, becomes this big military medical complex. Of course, West End itself is just dominated by Higgins Industries. Andrew Jackson Higgins builds his big manufacturing plants, and that's where the landing craft that were used for the invasions in Europe, for the island hopping in the Pacific, were built there in West End, as well as out by City Park, but just huge facilities built out in what's now the Orleans Marina and that West End area. So all of that is militarized and becomes part of the war effort. Then that just keeps expanding over. So you keep moving over from there. Not much you can do in terms of, you know, setting up manufacturing facilities by Bayou St. John. But then when you get past Bayou St. John, then the Navy opens up Naval Air Station New Orleans, basically right next door to Pontchartrain Beach. So it's the area now, so that's the area between, which is now the University of New Orleans main campus, basically from the London Avenue Canal back to Elysian Fields. There's that need for not only direct defense of the city, as it were, which, you know, I don't think anybody was overly worried about the Germans or the Japanese attacking New Orleans, but the development testing of the landing craft and the PT boats that were being built by Higgins Industries required monitoring, and so build a naval air station, an air facility there on the lakefront that can then monitor the testing of the boats and that sort of thing, and have basically an airstrip, an air base where you could land and take off planes. In addition to that, because that area was available, another big factory opened up right at what is now the end of Franklin Avenue. And Consolidated Aircraft Company built a big facility right there at Franklin Avenue where the Volti airplanes, I had said in a walk the other day, I had said the Catalinas, but I was wrong. It's the Volti, V-U-L-T-E airplane. Basically still a big seaplane. And the idea was that the Consolidated built this basically automobile-style Rail Assembly Plant right there at from Robert E. Lee to Franklin Avenue, Robert E. Lee to the lakefront on Franklin Avenue. And you start at the back end and build out the wheels and then build out the struts, put on a fuselage. And by the time you got stick in an engine, and by the time the plane had come through that assembly line, through that long factory, it just basically they just pushed it out into the lake as a finished seaplane. And then, of course, it would then take off and then go land back at the Naval Air Station, and then they'd ship them out to other, you know, fly them out or ship them out to other locations and then get them into the war. So in addition to the manufacturing and the Navy base, then the U.S. Army opens up a supply base that they named Camp Leroy Johnson in the area from on the other side of Franklin Avenue from the Consolidated plant running back to the Industrial Canal, and that was this big supply depot called Camp Leroy Johnson. And that becomes the that later becomes the UNO East Campus when the Army later in the 50s, in the 60s actually, turns that back over to the state. But you know, that, but the catch is, of course, that, you know, you've got this, so you've got a big Navy facility, you've got a manufacturing facility, and then you've got this Army base. And all this development along the lake gave Pontchartrain Beach a huge customer base. While employment picked up because of the war effort, nobody was heading out of town for vacations. You know, it was that kind of thing, that there still just wasn't a lot of money. And then, of course, you have gas rationing and everything else. Spending Saturday night at the beach was a great way to relax, settle down from the pressures and anxiety of the war. Pontchartrain Beach was all about affordable entertainment. Even if families couldn't afford the rides and the Midway games, which were a big deal because Harry Batt was very big on making sure that, you know, the attractions were very, very appealing, that mile-long white sand beach was just a popular place to go. You had the bathhouse, you could come out and just swim, didn't have to spend a ton of money for a day trip or just to go out. And that's pretty much how the beach operated throughout the 1940s. You know, as I said, the Batt really did a lot to really make the beach appealing and attractive, but money was still a thing. So then the war comes to an end, and not only does the war come to an end, but so that people are settling down, guys are coming home, the baby boom starts, that kind of thing. But also the Cold War kind of keeps going, so that you still have a very big military complex moving, still have a lot of things going on and money being spent because of the Cold War. And that has two major effects on Pontchartrain Beach. First, the Navy. The Navy had a need for longer runways for modern jet aircraft, and this forced them to relocate NAS New Orleans across the river to Belle Chasse. That left the land next to the amusement park open, and that eventually becomes Louisiana State University in New Orleans. Now, the story of how LSUNO comes into being, that's a, believe me, I'll be happy to tell that one because my dad working out there for so long, it's a wonderful thing. But then basically the Navy base closes, it's repurposed into a college. Camp Leroy Johnson remains as a supply base, but it's winding down. Its usefulness to the Army is not what it used to be. It's considered not essential, that sort of thing. And then that area just kind of, in particular, you know, by the 50s, just starts fizzling out and just not as significant. Operations there aren't a big deal. But the Consolidated Aircraft Plant was still there. It was still a big manufacturing facility, and it was repurposed by American Standard, the big plumbing fixture company. So it became basically, you know, plumbing fixtures and parts and that kind of thing, toilets and sinks, etc., that you'd see in residential, in homes and in bathrooms, apartments, bathrooms and apartments, that kind of thing. So that was a big deal and still provided a lot of good manufacturing jobs for the area. So the housing for since the two military facilities were gone, basically that all of that housing becomes repurposed and redeveloped as a levee board neighborhood, which becomes Lake Oak. And you've got that factory there that's providing jobs. The American Standard facility is out there still all the way up into the mid 80s. But it was a horrific, massive fire. The whole thing burned to the ground. Just incredible. So then now it's all used by the Orleans Parish Levee Board at this point. But after World War II, though, the baby boomer families, you know, start coming out and still continue to patronize the beach. You've got people moving out to the lake, but still you've got everybody coming up, you know, moving, expanding Gentilly in the late 40s throughout the 50s, so that basically the neighborhood is growing to and becomes the support for the amusement park. The lifting of rationing restrictions also makes it easier for travel around the country, and what that means to the beach is that the Bats, Harry Bat, could bring in out-of-town entertainment for performances on that stage at the center of the Midway. So Bat brings in acrobats and high wire acts and high divers and all those kinds of carny acts, carnival style acts, you know, guys that are, you know, folks that are just traveling through parts of the country and just on tour, if you will, in that sense. And, you know, you're able to do that now because you can, you know, gas isn't ration, you can get around better, that kind of thing. And then the musicians, of course, because not only do you have this ability for people to travel and then acts going out on the road, but now you've got the birth of rock and roll coming into the late, you know, coming into the early 50s and throughout the 50s, so that now not only do you have the ability to book musical acts on a weekend, but you've got all these rock and roll acts that you can bring out there and attract and appeal to a younger crowd, which is what, you know, you get the idea of the families coming out to go swimming on a, you know, during the day, during the summer, on the weekends, certainly. And then at nighttime, basically turn it back over to the younger folks, let them come out, see musical acts and that kind of thing. That was a huge big deal, would attract a lot of younger people and acts that appeal to them. Right up and including on Thursday, August 9th, 1956, a young man named Elvis Presley takes the stage at Pontchartrain Beach and just becomes part of New Orleans lore and legend at that point. So you've got there, you know, you see, you know, acts like Elvis are coming in and rockabilly acts such as that moving into the late 50s. The Navy base is becoming a college. People can just come, almost essentially just come across the street and go, you know, have a beer, have a hot dog, and go watch, go see a band, ride some rides. It's just the perfect combination of all of that together. And then, of course, always still the family aspect. Come out, go swim, have some fun. But the swimming piece eventually started to become problematic. The growth of Gentilly, Lakeview, and even Metairie as residential neighborhoods presented a new challenge, believe it or not, for Pontchartrain Beach. And that is, as people built homes along the lakefront, they also started dumping untreated sewage into the outfall canals that emptied, the drainage canals that emptied into the lake. You know, basically, the subdivisions were building out faster than sewage treatment and sewage and water board could keep up, and Jefferson Parish was even worse with this. And so what happened is you just had a lot of raw sewage being dumped into the lake, and that raised bacteria levels into the lake in the late, like 59 going into 60, you start seeing bacteria levels in the lake that made it unsafe for swimming. And the Bats responded to this because, of course, you've got this big beach and you've got this amusement park. You can't not swim at that point. So basically, the Bats responded to the challenge of pollution in the lake by building a big swimming pool complex right there, right just off the sand beach. So the Pontchartrain Beach builds out a big swimming pool facility. You know, you still had the big bathhouse and that complex, but instead of just walking out onto the beach and jumping into the lake, families could still hang out on the sand beach, then head back to the pools to actually swim. And this worked out great all the way up to 1964. But when the park was desegregated, then you had the problem of a mixed swimming pool and the marketing, and that was just not a good situation. And so, like a lot of public pools in New Orleans, or a lot of public swimming facilities, even though this one was privately owned, again, it's a court order and legal desegregation said that black folks had to be allowed into the beach, But the way to say, you couldn't just say, well, this is a whites-only pool. So the basically Playland Amusements closed, they chose to permanently close the swimming pools when the park was desegregated in 64. So for years, though, in terms of getting into the beach, for years, admission to Pontchartrain Beach was free. You had to pay for a locker in the bathhouse, and then, of course, access to the swimming pools was fee-based. But walking in, just coming into the beach and walking the midway, coming to see a show like going to see Elvis or something like that, all of that was free admission. You could just go walk up and you could walk up and down the midway, or sit on a bench and relax, or go out to the beach and not have to pay like a gated admission for an amusement park that we're used to now. That changes with desegregation. Desegregation changes the admission dynamic. There was concern, Playland Amusements was concerned, that allowing black folks into the park would basically scare off the white patrons. So the company decides to charge an overall admission fee to Pontchartrain Beach. So that the idea there was basically gate off the place, or fence off the place, and then charge admission so you come into the park for a base admission price. The rest of the attractions on the midway, the rides and the midway games and that kind of thing, were individually priced. Now, the theory was that black folks wouldn't be able to regularly pay the admission. That would kind of depress the black patrons coming into the park, and then that would put white patrons back at ease that, yeah, it's integrated, but they're really not coming here. That was kind of what happened at that point. Now, that evolved over time. What was an attempt basically to continue to segregate the park, just general the general dynamics and economics of the amusement park industry and the business kind of changed that around, so that basically what happened was that you start getting larger black subdivisions, in particular Pontchartrain Park off of Franklin Avenue starts developing. You start basically getting black folks, black families who are professional, working, either good labor jobs, and then professional families who are, of course, going to want to go to the beach just like anybody else. That kind of works itself out. You know, there's always the tension there throughout the 60s, but the admission, with black folks being able to pay the admission, they'd come in and do things and ride the rides just like everybody else, just there wasn't any swimming at that point. But what happens is that the whole thing sort of morphs in general. It's less about trying to keep black people out as it is just generally trying to stay competitive in the business, because by the mid-70s, out-of-town amusement parks, in other cities, such as the Six Flags parks in Dallas and Atlanta, Astroworld in Houston, then, of course, in the late 60s, it was 67, Disney World opens in Florida. All of these parks start moving to a single-price admission model. You know, you have a base admission. You know, of course, Disneyland had the A through E. Disneyland had the A through E tickets, and then things were individually priced in the beginning years at Disney World. But by the 70s, all of these other amusement parks are moving to a single-price admission model. And by 1974, Pontchartrain Beach does the same thing, and they start POP, pay one price. Patrons, you bought one ticket at the admission gate, and there was no longer additional tickets or for the rides. You just ride anything you want, pay one price. Midway attractions in the games, you know, the skee ball and the pinball games, knock down the cats, knock down the milk bottles, carnival midway games, of course, were still individually priced, but all the rides then became part of that pay one price. The beach had a lot of really, really nice rides, you know, anything from the Zephyr to the beach had a magnificent carousel with a Wurlitzer pipe organ that was actually live music in the carousel for decades until, you know, it was replaced by, you know, recordings as things went along and the park grew older. After World War II, well, even before war, before the war, Bat would go all over the country. He'd go to Europe and would look at different rides and look at possibilities for things to bring to Pontchartrain Beach. He was very, very active in that respect. After World War II, you know, because the war puts, you know, bringing things in from Europe obviously complicates that particular aspect of this. But after World War II, Bat goes out and buys a very interesting ride from a German engineering company or German design company called that was part a particular was a small roller coaster style. The ride was dubbed the Wild Mouse. And of course, the design was that of a compact coaster with small mouse-like cars, if you will, that seated four people. So instead of the big train, you had these individual little cars. The idea was the car was cranked up the roller coaster tracks, similar to a traditional coaster, but then basically did a series of dips, twists, and turns in a compact area, as opposed to just the big thrill of going down the big hill like a classic wooden roller coaster. And the Wild Mouse was a blast. And there were two incarnations of the ride, the original from the 1950s, and then as that one got a little further along in age and needed more repair, the ride was taken down and an expanded version built on the same in the same physical location in the park that was built in the 70s and then continued through until the park closed. So while the Bats were very, very good about bringing in the modern updates, rides to keep the park fresh, they always had done that. The switch to the POP model and just basically trying to hang with these other parks. You know, let's face it, driving over to Houston, even in the 70s, wasn't that big a deal. So making a trip over to Astroworld was easier by that point. So the pay one price model meant that the beach had to keep its game up. And again, you know, the Bats were good at this. The, you know, regularly brought in rides to complement the Zephyr. Now, the Zephyr was, of course, the big roller coaster at the front of the park. Big, huge wooden coaster, really fun to ride, and had been there since 1939 when the park opened in Milneburg. And then Harry Bat Sr., and the rest of the Playland Amusement people regularly brought in other rides to keep folks keep things interesting, fresh, and keep folks coming out. Most notably, the addition of a second roller coaster in the 1970s, a steel roller coaster with a full loop called the Ragin' Cajun was installed, and that was when I was in high school. That was a huge thing. That was just so much fun. Then you had the kind of spin-around rides and, you know, elevated rides and that sort of thing, such as the Trabant, the Music Express. Other rides of that sort came in and out of the park, cycled in and out as they were leased from other companies or set up and then bring in something newer. There was always also a haunted house of one kind or another. The initial haunted house in the late 30s and 39 into the 40s was called Laugh in the Dark. And then there was the haunted house. And then that became the Kooky Castle and that kind of thing. So there was always those midway kind of carnival attractions like that, both fast thrill rides like the coasters, bumpy, challenging thrill rides like the Wild Mouse, and then things that are, you know, a little slower, just, you know, kind of the haunted house type sort of Tunnel of Love kind of thing where, you know, you just ride through the dark and that sort of thing were always there and always fun as well. Food. Food at Pontchartrain Beach, well, it really was never much to write home about, right? Food was beach food, and New Orleans doesn't have a beach, so the cuisine kind of didn't really fit. But in a way, that was part of the attraction, right? Instead of going to a po' boy place or getting, you know, traditional plate of red beans or something like that, you're going out to the beach. And there was always this, there was right next to the main station for the Zephyr roller coaster, right there in kind of the center of the midway, if you will, was a counter service diner that basically served Coney Island Franks and burgers and that kind of thing. And the big beer sponsor was Jack's Beer. And the Zets company, 7-Up, 7-Up and Royal Crown Cola were very popular at the time as well. It was beach food. You know, grab a dog, grab a beer. Still, a lot of people would bring out a picnic lunch, or you just didn't really factor food into this. You know, when I, in the 70s, when I was in high school, you know, we would go hit up Bud's Broiler down on Pelopidas Street, or go to, you know, Francois Oyster Reef or a place like that, get a sandwich, get a little bite to eat, that kind of thing, and then just go out to the beach. And well, you know, it was a little easier then for teenagers to buy beer, so we did do that. But, you know, really the food thing just wasn't a big deal. Now, the main culinary attraction, of course, are the, and it's a, that's another story, which I'm not really qualified to tell because it wasn't really my thing, was the Ballyhigh restaurant, which was a full-service Polynesian tiki style restaurant located in the parking lot. Basically, it was a, you know, you could pull in and park at the beach and go to the Ballyhigh for dinner and not enter the beach. But then there was a back entrance that if you had paid for a ticket to the amusement park, you could get into the restaurant as well, or you could exit into the park at that point. The Ballyhigh, I'd been there once with the family when I was a kid. My memories are not that good of the place, and I assume that was because first off, my parents didn't have a ton of money, so going out and eating at a quote-unquote nice restaurant, they probably would be a little more picky about that, you know. And there's stories about Errol Laborde asking his wife, Peggy Scott Laborde, out, you know, their first date was at the Ballyhigh, and, you know, I'll do deference to Errol, they're a few years older than me, so, you know, that was a thing for them. Like I said, for us, it was Bud's Broiler and then go out to the beach, that kind of thing. But, you know, one of these days I'll do some more research on the Ballyhigh for that. But that was of course, a big deal. And then basically then, so coming through the 70s, the beach was still a solid local attraction. You had the still a lot of bands were coming out, local bands primarily at that point in the 70s, you know, like Beatles cover bands, Led Zeppelin cover bands, you know, that kind of rock and roll sort of thing, as well as country acts and other acts. And then, of course, by the 70s, of course, black bands and black acts, because now by the 70s, the park was fully integrated, and that was less of a thing or less of a tension or point. And the marketing was, again, to the entire Gentilly neighborhood, and that became, you know, that was just an integrated thing at that point. But the demographics of the area started shifting, and competition with the larger amusement parks. You know, these days, even in the late 70s, going into the 80s, you know, putting the kids on a bus, you know, for a CYO trip to Disney World or over to Astro World, that just became kind of a very, very easy thing for a lot of groups to put together or families to do. And that all takes its toll on Pontchartrain Beach. And so by the 80s, the park goes to a very, very steep decline. So that by 1983, Playland Amusement says, no, I'm sorry, New Orleans, we're done. And at the end of the 1983 summer season, Labor Day in 83, huge blowout, big fireworks, concert, everything, and the beach closes its doors. Later in the month, on September 23rd, 1983, Playland Amusements sells off the assets to the beach, and Pontchartrain Beach becomes part of New Orleans legend instead of being part of just day-to-day New Orleans. So Labor Day, yeah, every year it was that traditional end of the summer passage, but by 1983, it was just, that was it. And if you wanted to go ride rides and that sort of thing, you, from that point until the development of Jazzland, which then became Six Flags New Orleans, you really just, hey, you had to go out of town. You had to go over to Astroworld. You had to go up to Dallas or over to Atlanta or down to Florida. The beach itself is, still you had a lot of continued development. The legacy of the beach remains to the day. Fond memories of older New Orleanians when the Jazzland development in New Orleans East was opened. A big section of that was a midway that tried to evoke the Art Deco style of Pontchartrain Beach. The big roller coaster out at Jazzland was dubbed the Mega Zeph. Some people think the New Orleans Zephyrs, the baseball team, has to do with the roller coaster. It's actually because when the team was relocated, Colorado Rockies came into Denver, and the Denver Zephyrs had to move from the city because because the show was coming to town, and that's when the New Orleans landed the team, and rather than have to deal with a major name change, Zephyr was a thing. That was the Pontchartrain Beach roller coaster. So calling them the Zephyrs, people always thought that was the whole deal with the name. These days, the land is still in use. Of course, when the amusement park closed, the lease reverted back to the state of Louisiana, and the land was repurposed and became part of the UNO campus now. So it's now the University of New Orleans Research and Technology Park, which is the home of the university's School of Hotel, Restaurant, and Tourism, as well as the Lindsey Boggs International Conference Center. That's on the western side of the Mildenburg Lighthouse, and on the western side of Elysian Fields Avenue, and then you have the traffic circle, and then on the other side you have a DoD complex. It's the U.S. Navy's Space and Naval Warfare Systems Center. That's on the eastern side of the Mildenburg Lighthouse and the traffic circle. The sand beach along the lakeshore still exists. There's been projects over the years to try to rehabilitate it. The lake has been cleaned up a great deal in no small part through the efforts of the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation. And now that New Basin Canal Lighthouse, the foundation has worked diligently for years to restore that after Hurricane Katrina. And now you're starting to see, starting with last year in 2015, some projects and some development now to rehabilitate the sand beach area and reopen that for public access, kind of get around all of the UNO stuff and be able to go back out to the beach. Who knows? Hopefully that'll become a thing in the future. In the meantime, a lot of us still have those memories of, going out to the beach. Wow, that's pretty much our show for today. All of this, we're back in school now and the summer's over. And even if the beach was open, we'd have those memories of last weekend. So I hope this has been a little trip down memory lane for you. Goodness knows it's a fun thing for me. I walked around out there last weekend, did a little Facebook Live thing. I'll see if I can get that up on the website. We're going to have, the companion to this at NOLAHistoryGuy.com has a whole bunch of photos documenting the timeline of the beach and the attractions and some stuff there as well as what we've talked about here. So be sure to get out to the website. That's NOLAHistoryGuy.com. Also, for more on this, you'll want to check out Catherine Campanella's wonderful Arcadia book on Lake Pontchartrain and the history of the lakefront. That's really a fun thing. So all kinds of resources that we'll have available to you to spark your memory or inspire you and all that sort of stuff. So, okay. Thanks for your time. It's been fun. This is, it's like some of the stuff, it's like you it's good stories, but this is more for me than just good stories. It's fond personal experiences and memories. So I appreciate you joining me to share that today. You guys have a great weekend and a great next week, and we will talk to you again soon here at NOLA History Guy Podcast. Bye-bye.